Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about the connection between health and housing. A new report linking the two issues was unveiled recently at the Colorado Health Symposium that happened in Keystone, Colorado. We'll hear from the CEO of the Colorado Health Foundation that hosted last week's symposium. Then we continue our look at immigration and its impact on communities. This time, though, we'll take a look at what's happening in rural Colorado and how immigration raids are impacting communities on the Western Slope. On Resistance Radio, ahead of a vote that is happening this week, ballots must be returned by Wednesday by residents of the Stapleton community in Denver over whether or not to rename the area. Stapleton, of course, having links to a former Ku Klux Klan member. After headlines from the BBC, we'll get a brand new commentary from Jim Hightower, and then we'll hear about a 38-year-old human service organisation that was founded by Brenda Lyle back in 1981 in Boulder, the Family Learning Centre. KGNU's Liz Lane speaks with Brenda about her work and the legacy that she's creating. At 9 o'clock, it is media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. The second in command in the Denver District Attorney's Office will resign amid allegations of bullying and intimidation. Just a week ago, Denver District Attorney Beth McCann had said that Assistant DA Ryan Brackley would not lose his job after a consultancy firm found evidence that he had mistreated colleagues, including yelling at subordinates and pretending to swing a wooden baseball bat at another prosecutor's head. However, yesterday, McCann changed course. She emailed her staff saying that she could not let the controversy over Brackley's actions become, quote, an ongoing distraction from the important work and mission of the office, end quote. Brackley's last day will be Friday, August 2nd. Two brothers from Colorado who were responsible for a contaminated cantaloupe that killed 33 people back in 2011 are now facing drug charges in Kansas related to industrial hemp that they grow here in Colorado. Nine News reports that Eric and Ryan Jensen grow industrial hemp at a farm run by Eric's son in Holly, Colorado. They're now facing charges of shipping the hemp via FedEx through Kansas, where hemp is still illegal. The Jensen brothers pleaded guilty in 2013 to causing a nationwide outbreak of listeria through the infected cantaloupe grown at their farm. They were sentenced to home detention and ordered to pay thousands of dollars in restitution. The brothers told Nine News that they're still in debt from that and they've been trying to dig their way out of that situation through their hemp crop. They're now facing four drug offences in Kansas, including three felonies, and they're accused of distributing marijuana or possession of marijuana with the intent to distribute. Over the weekend, Democratic women convened for a boot camp designed to encourage more women on Colorado's Western Slope to get involved in politics. Colorado Politics reports that Emerge Colorado held their meeting in Mesa County, which is predominantly Republican. The three-day program was aimed at training the 26 women who attended to run for office, and particularly how to run for office in rural parts of the state. Colorado Politics reports that a quarter of the class was comprised of women of color, and three quarters of them say that they hope to run this year or next year for seats, including city council, county commissioner, school board, district attorney, and state legislative seats in both the House and the Senate. Longmont City Council will tomorrow resume discussion of what it wants to ask voters in this fall's election. The Times Call reports that questions that could be headed for the November ballot range from one that would ask voters' approval of a sales tax hike to another the sales tax hike that would finance the financing of a new indoor competitive swimming and ice rink facility. And another question would make the city's existing street fund sales tax permanent. And in the weather today, another warm day in the forecast for the Front Range. Expect highs close to 90 degrees in the low 90s with a chance of afternoon thunderstorms. Similar temperatures and conditions throughout the week, slightly warmer tomorrow, getting into the mid to possibly upper 90s around the Front Range, with that pattern of afternoon thunderstorms sticking with us through the end of the week. It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. Last week, the Colorado Health Symposium brought together a wide variety of experts in Keystone, Colorado, to discuss the connection between people's living situation and their health, the statewide housing crisis, and the housing inequity that still exists in Colorado. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with an individual who's been working on a new report that's focused on these issues. But first, we'll hear from Karen McNeil Miller, who is the CEO of the Colorado Health Foundation that hosted last week's symposium.
Having a stable, safe place to live mitigates physical conditions like heart conditions that may be caused by stress. Certainly, if you're able to live in a place with clean air and not be limited because of your income to pollution area or an area with high toxins in the environment, or that you're able to live in a place that doesn't have a lot of lead, that needs lead abatement, all those things have physical health outcomes to them. Asthma, heart disease, lung disease. And then on the behavioral health side, on the mental health side, just having the stability of a place to live doesn't cause stress. It frees up a family or an individual to be able to focus on the other things they need to do or want to do in order to have their family thrive. So that connection of housing and health is real and exists for all of us.
The Health Equity Advocacy Cohort, which is funded by the Colorado Trust, has been researching the current state of housing, health, and equity in Colorado and seven key populations in the state. In the next few weeks, they plan to publicly release their report, and I asked Emily Johnson, Director of Policy Analysis at the Colorado Health Institute, which has been working with the cohort on the project, to share some of the findings.
The first thing that's important to note is that housing insecurity sort of dives into a lot of different areas. So it's not just about affordability, it's also about accessibility. You know, can you get to things in your home? Can you get places in your community? It's about safety, whether your community is safe. But I do think that some of the most interesting statistics are probably around that housing cost burden. Housing cost burden is defined as a household that spends at least 30% of their income on housing. And we see that Colorado has the second highest rate of housing cost burden of all of the non-coastal states after Nevada. And I think that's something that we have felt a lot as residents of Colorado. We know that Colorado home prices have grown by 77% in the past 10 years, while income has grown by just 4.5%. And so I think that for me was a really standout statistic that spoke to what housing is currently looking like in Colorado. Another statistic is that homelessness is the most extreme consequence of housing instability in Colorado, and life expectancy among chronically homeless populations is 30 years shorter than it is among populations with stable housing, meaning that it's an average of about just 47 years.
So what are some of the reasons why housing inequity and housing and health-related inequities exist? Again, here's CEO of the Colorado Health Foundation, Karen McNeil Miller.
So in this country and in Colorado, as well, historical things that happened that segregated people into better areas to live, better ability to get loans, better ability to have economic opportunity, greater ability to build wealth through home ownership. And those were things that were outside of the control of the actual individual. So they were not given an equitable chance to reach the same success level as far as building wealth with purchasing a home or even having the kind of income that they could have in order to live in the place of their choice. And so what we want to have is a community or a state where everyone has the opportunity and the ability to live wherever they want, as opposed to some being able to live wherever they want and some being forced to or limited to certain places that they can live.
I also asked McNeil Miller what solutions she's seeing to this issue.
There are all kinds of levels to this complex problem. So for some smaller communities, particularly rural communities in Colorado, having money come through county government or city government to help build affordable housing for its public servants, like teachers, like law enforcement, firefighters, those folks who are providing a great public service that none of us can live without, if they're on the lower end of the earning power, and they may live in the communities where, in order to rent, they may be spending over 40% or half of their income. So it's hard to remain in a place where that's how much you have to spend to have a home. So you may then move somewhere else. And so some communities are using affordable housing for public servants as a recruitment and retention strategy. There's also, here in Colorado, we've got lots of resort communities where the people who the resorts rely on to be employees can't afford to live in those communities. So there are resort communities that are investing in building affordable housing for their seasonal workers or their full-time employees, their year-long employees. Also, other communities can, in their zoning requirements, they can zone and create mixed-use communities and mixed-income communities. So we don't warehouse all the poor people together, or we don't segregate people by race or segregate them by economics. There are other states or cities that will put in ordinances that say any new development of X number of units of apartments or housing has to have a certain percentage, let's say 30%, has to be affordable units or available to folks who are 80% or below of AMI, the adjusted median income. So those are just a few examples of some of the tactics that people are using.
And thanks to KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers for that report on the connection between housing and health. It is 8:18. You're listening to KGNU.
Support comes from the Dairy Arts Center presenting its 6th annual Dairy Center Honors event Friday, September 6th. The event honors Boulder individuals, groups, businesses, projects, and institutions that have made significant contributions to the arts in Boulder County. Guests will enjoy performances, drinks, and desserts, and a celebration of Boulder's cultural resources. Details at thedairy.org.
We have been doing a lot of coverage on the impact of current immigration policy on communities along the Front Range, and particularly in the light of increased ICE activity. Well, next, we're going to hear about the impact on rural communities, and particularly the impact on one rural mountain town in southwest Colorado. Here's Julia Caulfield.
In December 2018, Diego Hernandez was coming out of the courthouse building in Telluride after running an errand.
As I left, there was a man near the benches at the bus stop.
Hernandez says the man asked him for his name. Three other men came up to him and asked if he had documentation to show legal status in the U.S.
I told them no, but I had a pending case for a U visa and I had those documents in my backpack.
According to Hernandez, whose name has been changed for the purposes of this story, the officers didn't give him the time to show his visa paperwork. They asked him if he had any weapons or drugs on him. He said no, and they handcuffed him and put him in the back of a van. Hernandez says he has no criminal record. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials in Colorado say they aren't allowed to comment on a specific case without a signed privacy waiver from a detainee. Hernandez declined to sign a waiver, but ICE officials say with their, quote, finite resources, they focus arrests and detentions on those who pose a threat to the community or are national security threats. But they add it's their duty to, quote, carry out the arrest, detention, and removal of any person in the U.S. without proper documentation. According to Nelly Garcia, Hernandez's story is not surprising. Garcia is a Western Slope organizer for the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, a statewide nonprofit organization aimed at improving the lives of immigrants and refugees in Colorado. She's based in Grand Junction and says in the past few years on the Western Slope, they've seen an increase of people getting detained regardless of their criminal record.
10 years ago, we didn't see ice in Grand Junction, and especially in rural areas. It's really scary because I started following those procedures that they're supposed to be following. They're detaining people with no warrant, and then they're not going through making sure that they're not criminals.
Claudia Garcia Curcio, a DACA recipient and member of the Latino Advocacy Committee in Telluride, agrees with Garcia.
ICE does come to town frequently, which is scary. And, you know, by law, they're not supposed to profile.
She says LAC works with people so they know their rights when they encounter ICE. According to members of the Latino Advocacy Committee, in Telluride, ICE often approaches people in front of the courthouse. Hernandez was born in Mexico. He moved to Telluride when he was 25. That was 15 years ago. At first, he would come and go during the off seasons. Hernandez says the moment he moved here, he started working on assimilating. He took classes to learn English. He filed his taxes. He says he did everything he could to be part of the community. Once his son was born, he and his wife made Telluride their home full time. On the day he was arrested, he says he dropped his son off at school and told him he'd pick him up at the end of the day. But he never made it. Instead, Hernandez was taken into custody. He says he was put in a van and ICE officers took him to Grand Junction. There, he says the officers took his fingerprints and interviewed him about his past.
Afterwards, I waited until around 11 o'clock at night, and they loaded two of us into a van, me and another man they had arrested in Montrose, and they put the same cuffs around our ankles, waists, and wrists, and loaded us into an old, ugly van with a driver and another guard.
From there, Hernandez says he and the other man were taken to the detention center in Denver. He describes the processing center, the place he was kept before going to the detention center, like a maximum security prison.
We were completely alone in a small cell with no contact with others. There was a small sink, a toilet, and a table with two chairs. If we needed anything or asked any questions, they spoke to us through the door as if we were criminals. During my time there, right hand to God, I had never been through anything like that in my entire life.
Once in the detention facility, Hernandez says he was held with around 80 other detainees, split into cells with four people each. He says they were allowed outside for a short time each day.
Most of the time, we sat crowded watching television, waiting for time to pass or for the next mealtime.
Hernandez also recounts helping other detainees get the medical care they needed. He says unless you spoke English, it was hard to get medical attention. Reporting in recent months from multiple news outlets have also raised questions about the quality of medical care provided at the detention center in Denver, including the death of a detainee at the center in 2017. According to ICE officials, ICE takes, quote, the health, safety, and welfare of detainees seriously. After 3 weeks in the detention center in Denver, Hernandez was released on bond. He's back in Telluride with his family, but he says the experience changed his experience of the community. Organizer Nelly Garcia says the fear of detention can have broader impacts on the community, including underreporting crime. She says it's important for the immigrant community to start building trust with local law enforcement.
We just had a meeting with the Montrose sheriff, and he assured us that he's not working with ICE and that he's not sharing information and that they don't want them to work with them because that just breaks the trust between the community and them.
Claudia Garcia Curcio says locally, Telluride is working to be more open about conversations surrounding immigration.
Like, I think more people are definitely reaching out, and I've even worked in the courts and with the DA, and we've been, you know, can we do call-ins, you know, instead of having the fear of them coming into the courts. I feel like we've opened, I guess, the door in conversations that I don't feel shy or scared to ask these questions.
But Garcia Curcio says that's not always enough.
I mean, we've worked through a lot of things. We're still working on them, you know, and I don't think the fear is ever going to go away.
In 2018, ICE arrested over 400,000 people in the U.S. and deported over half of those arrested. Around 6,000 of those arrests happened in Colorado. From January to March of 2019, ICE and Customs and Border Patrol arrested over 60,000 people across the United States. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Julia Caulfield.
It is 25 minutes past 8 o'clock, and it's time now for Resistance Radio. Well, residents of the Stapleton community in northeast Denver have been for years resisting the actual name of the community because of its namesake's ties to the Ku Klux Klan. Rename Stapleton for All is a community group that initially approached individual stakeholder groups in the community asking them to drop Stapleton from their names. Now, several organizations did. For example, the Stapleton Foundation became the Foundation for Sustainable Urban Communities. Well, last year, Stapleton residents got to vote on whether to change the official Registered Neighbourhood Organisation, or RNO, whether to change that name from Stapleton United Neighbours to Central Park United Neighbours. Now, 58% of ballots favoured the name change. However, there was a required threshold of 66% needed to actually make the change. Well, the fight continues. In June, Stapleton's MCA, now that's governed by a board of directors and it's advised by delegates from the community, they mailed ballots to property owners in Stapleton asking them about a name change, giving them the opportunity to suggest new names for the community. Now, those ballots are due in this coming Wednesday, July 31st, and an outcome is expected to be announced in August. Well, last May, ahead of that vote on the Registered Neighbourhood Organisation name change, I spoke with Liz Hogan-Stalnecker, and she's with Rename Stapleton for All, and I asked her, why is there such passion and controversy about the name Stapleton?
The issue with the name is that Benjamin Stapleton in the 1920s was a mayor of Denver, a Klan member, and as mayor, he kind of appointed other Klan members to important offices in the city and enabled Klan activity. And that's part of the history that people want to draw attention to. As far as activism in the community, it actually goes back the very first days of the development. Before ground was broken on the first house, people brought up the issue with the name Stapleton and that they did not want the name Stapleton kind of applied to this new urbanist community that was supposed to be very inclusive and encourage diversity. The fact that the name Stapleton was problematic because it was the name of a former mayor who was a Klan member, that it was a name being given to a neighborhood that was being presented as this kind of new urbanist dream of inclusivity and diversity, that was kind of presented before ground was broken on the first house. And so a resolution was made that the name Stapleton would be used initially as a locator and for marketing purposes to kind of just allow people to have a name applied to the neighborhood, but that the use would be phased out in an official capacity as the different neighborhoods within the community would get their own names that didn't include the name Stapleton. And, you know, we're like 18 years later and we know how that worked out. It's not, you know, it's still a central part of how people call this community. It's a central part of the marketing of the developer. And so basically every time this has been brought up again, it's always been as a course correction to kind of remind people, hey, look, we said this was a problem before. So in 2002, I believe it was brought up. More recently in 2015, Black Lives Matter 5280 drew attention to the problem with the name, and then we see Rename Stapleton for All as a continuation of kind of all of the community groups who have brought this up over the years, and every time it gets brought up, there's more support within the community for renaming, for taking a critical look at our history and making a conscious choice to decide, okay, who do we honor with our name? What kind of community do we want to live in? So, I mean, there's a lot of other issues that are part of this in terms of equity and inclusion in our neighborhood and affordable housing. So the name is just a start, but the name is an important start.
That's Liz Hogan-Stalnecker, who's with Rename Stapleton for All. I spoke with her last summer ahead of a vote on changing the Stapleton name. Now residents are getting a chance this month to also weigh in on new names for the Stapleton community. Those ballots are due in by Wednesday and the outcome is expected to be announced in August. It is 8:30. You're listening to KGNU. Don't forget, you can find lots of events listed on our Resistance Radio calendar, as well as interviews on Resistance Radio, all online at news.kgnu.org. Click on Resistance Radio.